Hello. In this audio snippet, we're going to continue talking about Lincoln and how he handled the Civil War. And we had last spoken about the Emancipation Proclamation and how at the beginning that declaration, that executive order, you could say, was to a certain extent useless. Because it didn't liberate too many people when it was declared, and it was deliberately written in such a way that it would free very few slaves, and we talked about the areas. The Union-occupied areas in the Confederate states, where the proclamation took effect immediately, and it was a list of very small towns, and the slaves who were quote liberated in the rest of the South remained slaves because they were under Confederate control, and so, in a certain way, maybe intentionally or unintentionally, from the standpoint of Lincoln, the Emancipation Proclamation radically changed the impetus or the driving force of the Union Army itself, because it's as if the Union Army went from being this defensive force trying to restore order in rebelling territories, you know, like a police force going into an area to control a mob that is out of control, that is destroying property or doing things like that. The Union Army went from that mode, that defensive mode, to one of aggression. Like, we are going into the South to set slaves free. And so when it went into that offensive mode because of this Emancipation Proclamation, the nature of the fighting radically changed. And then the Union Army began to march, and as they began to conquer new territories, they would set the slaves free based on this proclamation. And that also helped motivate black people to join the Union Army as they marched into the South, because now they were being set free and also fighting for the freedom, for their own freedom. So it just radically changed the nature of the war, the tone of it, which Lincoln could have done from the very beginning if he had had a different attitude. But he, as we have explained before, his attitude was one of, I don't care about slavery, all I want is to preserve the Union. And as we've also said many times before, there was no Union to preserve. The Union had been ripped apart. There was a divorce based on the constitutional system that the Founding Fathers stupidly left behind with federalism. The states had the right to secede and be their own people because they willingly entered into the Constitution. And according to conservatives and the Founding Fathers' thinking, they are the ones who gave legitimacy to the Constitution. So it was also their prerogative to step away from it. So there was no Union to preserve. Once they seceded, they were gone, and they were a different country. And the Union Army was, in fact, an invading force, just like when America invaded Mexican territory and took Mexican territory from Mexico. In the same way, the Union Army was entering into a foreign country and conquering it. There was nothing to preserve. That's just the legal reality and the consequence of what was founded in the 1700s by the founding fathers. Now we're going to talk a little bit about the army, what was going on with the military, the Union military at the time. And the first leader of the Union Army was Winfield Scott. Not too many people know about him, but he was the first leader of the Union Army after Lincoln was inaugurated. And he was already the leader of the American Army, you could say, at that time. It was not... In other words, Lincoln did not appoint him to that position, and he was from Virginia. In other words, he was a Southerner, and from a slave state, and so there was a concern as to whether he would be loyal to the Union and to Lincoln. So Lincoln asked him if he would be loyal. And to the Union, and this fellow Winfield Scott replied, quote, "I shall consider myself responsible for your safety," you know, referring to Lincoln. And he protected Lincoln on his way to Washington and during the inauguration, because there were concerns that Lincoln's life was at risk after he had been elected, which prompted the seven southern states to secede from the Union. So we have to remember, they did not secede after Lincoln took office. They seceded before Lincoln took office because Lincoln had been elected, because in the U.S. system, there's a period of time between the election and the president actually taking office. And and there were concerns that someone from the South would try to kill Lincoln before he became president, or maybe someone with loyalty to the South or fanaticism towards slavery, in favor of slavery. So he was a Southerner. But he decided to kind of follow orders. He was the leader of the Union, the commander of the Union Army, of the American Army, and his loyalty was to the army that he had been a part of. So he was like being a good soldier, and he was following orders. Now his duty was to protect this man. And it didn't matter to him whether he liked the man or didn't like the man. It was just part of his duty. And that all sounds very good. And it's good to some extent. But it reflects part of a problem, an underlying problem that we will try to talk about in this audio snippet related to the U.S. military. And also to Lincoln's thinking for having this man around. And not that there was anything too evil about him, but we'll talk about that a little bit in a short while. Now, this Winfield Scott, he proposed what came to be called the Anaconda Plan, and his thought was to capture the Mississippi River and do a blockade of southern ports. His idea was, I don't want to inflict too much damage on the South. We want to choke it into surrender. That's what it was called, the Anaconda Plan, where they wanted to surround the South and kind of blockade it and make it suffer, just like when you would do a siege of a city in the old days. And the idea is that the South would eventually buckle. So he was not a proponent of like a direct attack on the South. And I think that in part had to do with his Southern roots and he didn't want too much bloodshed to happen, and he thought that was going to solve the problem. And this Anaconda plan got leaked out, and when it got leaked out to the press, it got ridiculed, and everybody thought it was the most stupid idea, and therefore it was dropped, and they didn't follow through with it. So this Winfield Scott at the time of the start of the Civil War in 1861 was too old, for battlefield command. So Lincoln selected a guy named Irwin McDowell, who was an officer that Scott didn't really like, and he selected this McDowell fellow to lead the Union Army in the Eastern Theater. And Scott always thought this McDowell fellow was unimaginative and inexperienced, but that's who Lincoln chose. Whilst this McDowell was leading the Eastern Theater of the Union Army, Winfield Scott started telling Lincoln, "We need more time to train," because he wanted to kind of train the Union Army and prepare it further before they did anything against the South. And Lincoln said, "No, let's go and charge against Richmond." So he really wanted to. Richmond was the capital, you could say, of the Confederacy. I think it was later moved I forget the city where it was moved to eventually, but originally, if I'm not mistaken, the capital of the Confederacy was Richmond, Virginia, which is right next to below, you could say, Washington, D.C. So it was like close to the border between North and South, and it was the heart, you could say, of the Confederacy. And Lincoln thought, let's just go and conquer, let's take Richmond, and let's have this over with. So he wanted this quick blow to the South to kind of end it all, because he really didn't understand, I believe, the severity of the rift between North and South. He thought, oh, okay, let's just go and take Richmond, and that'll be the end of that, and the South will say, oh okay, let's forget about this whole rebellion thing, and we'll just go back to the way we were. McDowell, because he was the one in charge of the Eastern Theater, he listened to Lincoln and said, okay, yeah, let's go attack Richmond. And he went and attacked Richmond, and he was soundly defeated in what's called the First Battle of Bull Run. I think in the South it's called Manassas, the First Battle of Manassas or something like that. Because the North and the South, in the history books, named each of the battles by different names. I think the South always named it by a river, and the North always named it by some other factor. But regardless, that battle was lost by the North, and that meant that the war was not going to end quickly, as Lincoln was hoping. And I do believe this is, you could say, destiny, making sure that that things would not be allowed to return to normality, because normality at the time was this divided nation that allowed slavery, blatant slavery in parts of it. And Lincoln wanted to go back to that normality. And thankfully, he had inept generals and inept people and unrighteous people in the army that prevented him succeeding in quickly bringing the South back into the, quote, Union fold, you could say. After what happened, then Blinken said, okay, we need to make some changes here. So he replaced Winfield Scott with another fellow called George McClellan. And he would often meet with this McClellan without Winfield Scott being present. So Scott began to kind of see himself sidelined. And because his health was diminishing, he decided, okay, I'm not wanted here. I'm not feeling too well physically, so I just might as well retire. So he resigned in October of 1861. So if I remember correctly, the Civil War started in April of 1861. So this was, you could say, 6 months into the war, Winfield Scott said, I'm out of here. And on his way out, Winfield Scott recommended a man named Henry Halleck, a guy not from the South, but a person born in New York State. And he recommended Henry Halleck as his successor. But Lincoln didn't like Halleck and stuck with McClellan. And interestingly, Halleck was a Democrat. This Henry Halleck was a Democrat who sympathized with the South when the Civil War began, but he believed in the value of the Union. So you can see that there were a lot of these people at that time who were either sympathetic or neutral towards the South and its slavery, but were in it, in the fight, just like Lincoln, to quote, preserve the Union or save the Union. That was their interest, and slavery was always like, oh, that, we don't care about that. We just want the country put back together. And Halleck was one of these people. And Halleck happened to replace Fremont, the person we talked about earlier, John Fremont in Missouri, when Fremont was stupidly removed by Lincoln. And this Halleck fellow was a good administrator, but a very cautious general. And that's the other factor that we see. People who want to preserve or save the Union and who are acting cautiously whilst doing so. And that's just the basic recipe of modern day conservatism. And conservatism from the beginning, from the founding fathers forward, it's always this this cautious hesitation to act, and that's why conservatives and people of this ilk are always on the defensive. And as we've said, they are not revolutionaries. They're always reactionaries. They're always reacting to somebody else's actions. Conservatives never take the offensive. They're always reacting to the evil being done by liberals. And that's what makes them very ineffective. They are, I don't know if I mentioned this before, but they are like the Irish national football, or soccer as they call it here in America, the Irish football team. I remember as a kid when I'd watched the Ireland team in international matches or in the World Cup, it was always weird to me that Ireland would the score would always be, whenever Ireland was involved, it would always be 0-0 or 1-0. It was never 3-2 or 3-1 or anything like that. It was always 0-0 or 1-0. And maybe if they were playing a very, 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 very bad team, then they would win 2-0, or maybe, you know, get very lucky if they were playing, let's say, the Uganda under 16 team or something like that, then they would win 3-0 or something to that effect. But when they face strong opponents, they're either tie or 0-0 or 0-0 or lose 1-0. And it was when you'd watch the game, you'd understand why. Ireland, for some reason, always had this very, very strong defense. They would be very well organized in the on their side of the field, and the other team always had trouble scoring against them. But by the same token, they were either because they were so much in defensive mode or just because they were not that good, they just couldn't score on the other side. They would pass the ball and move forward past midfield. And once they got a little bit past midfield, like maybe three quarters of the way to the other goal, they just never seemed to know what to do. And they didn't have forwards with this offensive mindset to attack. That's why they always had a hard time scoring despite having this world-class defense. I don't know if that's the same situation nowadays. I haven't watched football for a while, but that's how it was for many years. And that's the conservative party or the conservative movement or people in America. That's exactly what they look like the Irish national football team. They're very defensive, very strong, and very sound in defense, but they couldn't score against a good team if their life depended on it, because they just don't go forward. They just don't attack. They're always reacting. So this Halleck fellow was of that ilk, the cautious guy. Just like Winfield Scott was cautious in his own way. Oh, we need to train the army. We want to, let's not fight just yet. Let's just do the anaconda dance for a while. And Lincoln was in a hurry. So it sounds like he was being aggressive and the offensive. But no. All he wanted was a quick shot at Richmond. And supposedly that'd be enough to have victory and have it all over with. So he was not really on a conquest path, because he thought he saw the whole thing as some sort of constitutional crisis that could be resolved with one big blow, instead of realizing no, this is a fundamental separation of a country into two, and two legitimate countries because of how the Founding Fathers had established the first one, the original one. But the thing is that, so Halleck was in Missouri after replacing John Fremont in that part of the battle, you could say. And he began to butt heads with Ulysses S. Grant, who was his most successful subordinate at the time. So Ulysses Grant was under him, and he was doing well, but they started having conflicts between them. And it's interesting because Ulysses S. Grant, as you may know, was the one who eventually became the Union Army leader and was the one who, with Sherman, won the war, the Civil War, for Lincoln and for the country, for the North. So you can see how, two people, one with the conqueror mentality, was constantly clashing with someone who was just in reactionary conservative mode. That's how destructive conservatism is. It starts to drown out the people who want to really make a change. Halleck at one point wrote to Sherman, I believe, to someone. He wrote to them the following, and I want to read what he said, because this goes to the heart of what we want to talk about in this audio snippet. And he said, quote, I am simply a military advisor of the Secretary of War and the President, and must obey and carry out what they decide upon, whether I concur in their decisions or not. As a good soldier, I obey the orders of my superiors. If I disagree with them, I say so. But when they decide, it's my duty to faithfully to carry out their decision, unquote. And that sounds all well and good, but it goes to the heart of a problem. He was simply a soldier, obeying orders, being told what to do. He may or may not agree. He may, you know, kind of voice his difference of opinion, and then he would just go ahead and do what he was told. And when you have an army, an entire military full of people who think like that, what you get is a whole bunch of what I would call toy soldiers that you wind up. So you have this person from above somehow winding the toy soldier up, and then putting it on the ground and it starts moving, because you wound him up, and they don't have a soul, they don't have a will, they don't have anything in them. They're just obeying orders and acting out on it, and that's why a lot of these people couldn't have cared less about slavery, or were actually sympathetic towards slavery and towards the South and towards states' rights and all that stuff. But they were in the army, and whether they liked it or not, they were going to fight for the North. So this is the kind of mentality we had going. The people who were in the military in high positions of power. So now that we're here, let's talk about who the Secretary of War was. Because in the quote he said, "I'm simply a military advisor of the Secretary of War." I think the Secretary of War is now called the Secretary of Defense. I could be wrong on that, but there's no longer a quote Secretary of War in the United States. But I think it was just renamed to Secretary of Defense, which is interesting because it goes to all that we've been saying. The Irish national team always play defense. So it's kind of fitting, if that is the case, that the office was changed from war to defense. Who was the Secretary of War? His name was Edwin Stanton. And he's another relevant figure in the war. So we need to talk about him to get a sense of him, because it's important to go through these people and kind of get a sense of what they were like, how they thought. And these were the people that Lincoln tolerated and had around. So a lot of these people say a lot about him, not just about themselves. So this Edwin Stanton was not from the South. He grew up in Ohio, and in his earlier days, he was a supporter of Andrew Jackson, and Andrew Jackson was what led him into the Democrat Party. So he was a Democrat. Now think about that. He was a Democrat, a supporter of Andrew Jackson, who, as we briefly mentioned before, was a bitter Southerner and slave owner and pro-slavery guy through and through. As I shared with you, I have a deep, I don't know if the word's resentment, but a deep dislike of this man, Andrew Jackson. He's considered one of the greatest presidents. He's on the $20 bill, if I'm not mistaken, the U.S. $20 bill. But I simply dislike the man. I think he did more harm than good. But the thing is, this Edwin Stanton was a supporter of this guy. But oddly enough, despite being a supporter of him, Edwin Stanton was strongly anti-slavery. But that happened after his conversion to Episcopalianism. So he had a spiritual conversion, and because of that, he became very anti-slavery. And that's one thing liberals don't understand, that when they criticize, slavery and racism in America and all that, they always pin it on the Christians, like the white devout Christians, conservative Christians are the reason for slavery. but they don't realize or don't understand that the vast majority of abolitionists or of people who actively fought against slavery were devout Christians. And it was their devotion to Christianity that prompted them to be so strongly anti-slavery. And the so-called Christians who were more wishy-washy and less committed to Christianity were the ones who were more tolerant of slavery. So this Edwin Stanton did oppose slavery because of his conversion, but even so, he remained a Democrat. And remember, the Democrat Party became the party of slavery and racism. And I think, in a sense, it always was, but it became more and more openly pro-slavery. So if you were pro-slavery, you basically had to be in the Democrat Party. The Republican Party rose as the alternative, so that people who were Democrats and were anti-slavery could get away and be in a party that would be more to their more in agreement with their views. So he remained a Democrat, and he even served as the Attorney General under James Buchanan. So he was Attorney General under the guy right before Lincoln. But he actually did this like Buchanan's soft stance towards South Carolina's secession declaration, because South Carolina was the first one to declare secession, saying we're out of here, we don't want to be with the Union anymore. And that was under James Buchanan. And James Buchanan, at the end of Buchanan's term, I believe, when he was a lame duck, what they call a lame duck president, after Lincoln had been elected. So Edwin Stanton wanted Buchanan to act very strongly. Okay, South Carolina, you're seceding. Oh, he wanted Buchanan to go and invade South Carolina and take it back, but Buchanan was cautious. You know, there was always this caution. You know, and that's part of the one of the cancers in the American way of thinking. It's always, oh, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. If it ain't broke, don't fix it. It's not a matter of getting it right. It's just that, does it work? Yes, it works. Are we having any problems with it recently? Or is it workable? Can we make it work by fixing this one quick thing? Yes, okay, let's do that, instead of dealing with underlying issues. So so he didn't like Buchanan because of his soft reaction to the South's secession. And so when Lincoln came and took office, he liked, he thought that Lincoln was going to be the solution and would take a tougher stance than Buchanan, but was very disappointed that Lincoln, during his inauguration, did not talk about outlawing slavery. And that's very important. We have to say this. It's not just that he was being kind of clever, and saying, not saying too much, but thinking something else on the inside. Lincoln really didn't care about ending slavery, and that's why he didn't include it in his inauguration. And Edwin Stanton noticed that and was disappointed and said, okay, I thought things were going to change drastically, but this guy seems to be a little like the guy that he's replacing, Buchanan. So when Lincoln took office, he appointed a man named Simon Cameron as his first Secretary of War. And early on, as the war started, Simon Cameron became constantly accused of incompetence, and that's because of his early losses, because the Union was not doing well at the beginning. And it's because there was something fundamentally wrong with the whole way things were set up. And it's as if God was not going to allow the country to be kind of like put back together with Band-Aids, unless the root issue was dealt with once and for all. So it was a good thing that they were fumbling and stumbling, because otherwise we would have just returned to the same stupidity, and then that would have just kicked the can down the road, as they always say. So Simon Cameron was having problems, and he was being blamed for the losses and everything, but it was really more because of the generals that Lincoln had on the field at the time. But, you know, things were not looking good. He was the one in charge, technically, or theoretically, and some people wanted him to resign. So Cameron then sought out Edwin Stanton to advise him, you know, the previous attorney general under James Buchanan. He sought him out to advise him on legal matters concerning the War Department's acquisitions and so forth, and other things. And that's how Edwin Stanton kind of became involved with the Secretary of War position. And then calls for Cameron to resign grew louder when he endorsed a speech in November of 1861 by a colonel called John Cochran. Colonel John Cochran gave a speech to his unit. And Cameron, the Secretary of War, found out about the speech and declared his support for it. And let me read to you a quote of what this John Cochran, I was going to say Johnny Cochran, but God forbid, that guy's that's a little cockroach that was around in the 1990s and died, thankfully, some almost 20 years ago. Let's not talk about that piece of rubbish. But this guy's John Cochran, a different John Cochran. I don't know how to pronounce the name. I believe it's Cochran. And he said to his unit, quote, "We should take the slave by the hand, placing a musket in it, and bid him in God's name strike for the liberty of the human race," unquote. That's what the colonel, John Cochran, said to his unit in a speech in November of 1861. And Simon Cameron heard it, and to his credit, he said, let's do that. So he embraced that sentiment that slaves should be armed. But when he began to voice that sentiment, it was met with repudiation by Lincoln and his whole cabinet. In fact, the secretary in the Department of Interior, Caleb Smith, scolded Cameron, you know, for doing that. So he was being criticized by Lincoln and the cabinet for having for voicing this support of this idea that the North was supposed to arm black slaves to help fight for the liberty of the human race. So this John Cochran was trying to inject a moral undertone to the fighting, like saying we have a moral cause to fight, and we are going to enlist the support of these black men, help, and let's arm them, let's help them, let's have them join us to fight for liberty. Doesn't that sound like the right thing to fight for? Fight for liberty? Isn't that what the Revolutionary War was about? Fighting for liberty, life, liberty, the pursuit of happiness, and all that nonsense. And I say nonsense not because there was no reality to it. Don't get me wrong. I'm saying nonsense because the whole thing was placed on a wrong foundation. So even though we were nominally fighting for liberty, we were fighting for a certain type of compromised liberty. But that was a rallying cry for the Revolutionary War. And this man was trying to use that to do the same rallying cry to fight the Civil War. And Simon Cameron, to his credit, you know, because he had this religious or spiritual conversion and became devoutly anti-slavery, but was still working within the system. When he heard John Cochran, something in his spirit just was stirred. And he said, that's it. That's what we have to do. And if they had allowed that to come in, like that spirit of a moral force, if they had allowed it to come into the Union Army, I'm sure that things would have turned around very quickly for the Union Army and for Simon Cameron's reputation, because they would have started winning immediately. But no, they're, oh no, no, God forbid that we should start going on this moral crusade, of liberating slaves and arming them to help them join us and fight for liberty. No, oh, God forbid. So as this happened, Cameron, to his credit, and I do credit him for this, he inserted a call to arm the slaves in his report to Congress. So he had to write this report to Congress, and he inserted a call to arm the slaves in that report. And that would be sent along with Lincoln's address to the legislature. So Cameron gave the report to Edwin Stanton, and Edwin Stanton, who, as we said, had gotten involved with the Secretary of War, he amended that with a passage that went even further in demanding that slaves be armed, stating that those who rebel against the government lose their claims to any type of property, including slaves, and that it was, quote, clearly the right of the government to arm slaves when it may become necessary, as it is to use gunpowder or guns taken from the enemy, end quote. So this Edwin Stanton took this speech and basically kind of like, kind of used the South's language against them, because the South kept saying, you know, blacks are not real people, they're just property. So don't you come touch my property, you know, don't tread on me, you son of a bitch. I'm going to bite you like a rattlesnake if you tread on me, if you try to take away my property. So Edwin Stanton would say, okay, they are property to you. Well, then the moment we go in and defeat you, it's like when you take gunpowder from a conquered or defeated enemy and use it, take it, confiscate it, and use it to go, continue fighting against your enemy. So he said, well, it's like taking gunpowder from your enemy, conquered enemy or defeated enemy. We're going to take your slaves and use them against you. So we have the right to do that. So, because they are your property, right? They're not real people. So we'll use that terminology, and apply it in this case, against you. And Cameron gave, the report to Lincoln, and sent several copies to Congress and the press. And when Lincoln saw this, he was outraged. He wanted the portions containing calls to arm the slaves removed, and he ordered that transmission of the Cameron's report to the press be stopped and replaced with an altered version. And as it turns out, Congress received the version that didn't have that call to arm, for slaves, and the press. Because, you know, the transmission had begun of this press release, the press had the copy with the call to arm the slaves. So that means that the press found out that this speech was, or this report by the Secretary of War included this, but Congress did not get that version of it. And when the newspapers published the version with the call to arm the slaves, Lincoln was excoriated by Republicans. He was excoriated by both sides, by Republicans, because they thought that he was weak on the issue of slavery, because they saw, oh, wait, Lincoln, you took this out of this report? What's wrong with you? And then he was also criticized by the other side, the people, you know, who were not very happy with the war and fighting against the South and against slavery and all that. But so it created this conflict and exposed Lincoln for what he was. He was half-faced or half-compromised individual. He always was. Because of all this controversy, that Simon, you know, all this trouble that he put Lincoln in, because he exposed him, then Lincoln said, okay, I'm going to get rid of Simon Cameron. And he did so when the abolitionists calmed down after the controversy. So he waited for the whole thing to kind of like settle down a bit, for the Republicans to stop being so angry at him. And when that anger subsided, he said, okay, now I'm going to get rid of this guy, this troublemaker who wants to arm the slaves. So he got rid of him. And that's when Edwin Stanton came in, which is ironic because I guess Lincoln didn't understand that Stanton was the one who had made the language even more powerful for the call to arm slaves in that report. So that's some of the people there, and as you can see, it exposes a lot about them, and it exposes a lot about Lincoln's behavior. So now let's try to talk a little bit about McClellan, the guy who became the leader of the Union Army after Winfield Scott was kind of sidelined and somehow forced to resign, you could say. This McClellan fellow was born in Philadelphia, so he's from the North. You would think, okay, this is a guy who's going to fight for freedom, born in the city with the Liberty Bell, so he'd be all for liberty and fighting for the freedom of all men. All men are created equal, all that good rubbish that the Founding Fathers said. And again, it's not that they didn't believe in it in many ways. It's not that there was no legitimacy to what they were saying. It's just that it was said on a wrong foundation. So a lot of those words in many ways became meaningless. Even though they did believe it in many ways, they were sincere in many good things. And they put in many good things into the fabric of the society, of the American society. But things survived in the American society because of the American people and their character, not because of the system that the Founding Fathers left behind. It's like we had good players, but not a good coaching system, not a good strategy. We didn't have a good manager managing the team, but we just had very good players, and that's how we've survived. But talent sometimes can only go so far. You have to have a good strategy, a good foundation to be a real champion. And America didn't have that. So that's why I always criticize and sound so derisive of things about the Founding Fathers. Not so much because there was anything wrong with the concepts that they promoted per se, but because of how they thought about implementing those concepts. This guy, McClellan, was born in Philadelphia. You would think he would be for life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness and all that good stuff. But he wasn't. At the start of the Civil War, he was admired because of his knowledge of what was called the quote big war science. So he apparently was very good academically in terms of military strategy, and he had railroad experience that suggested he might excel at military logistics. So he was in great demand as the Union army began to mobilize, and the governors of different states like Ohio and Pennsylvania and New York, the three largest states of the Union at the time, they actively pursued him to come to their state to command their state's militia. In fact, the Ohio governor, William Dennison, was very persistent, the most persistent of all the governors. And so McClellan kind of accepted and was commissioned a major general of volunteers and took command of the Ohio militia on the 23rd of April of 1861. That was at the very start of the war. But the thing is, unlike some of his fellow Union officers who came from abolitionist families, he was opposed to interference with slavery, federal interference. So being from Philadelphia, you'd think he would be anti-slavery, strongly anti-slavery and pro-freedom. But no, he was, no, the federal government has no power over slavery, no authority over it. So if I am working in the army, in the military, which is part of the federal government, then we can't, I have, as a federal officer, you could say, no authority over the issue of slavery, and we should not get involved with that. That's none of our business. That was his thinking. This is the guy that Lincoln put as the leader of the Union Army. Just think about that. So for this reason, you know, because of his neutral stance, if you can call it that, towards slavery, some of his Southern colleagues actually approached him informally and tried to ask him, okay, do you want to side with us, with the Confederacy? But he would not accept the concept of secession. It was like, okay, I'll be a good soldier. I'm in the army. I made an oath of loyalty, so I'll stay loyal to the army. I don't like what's going on. I don't like where this is going. But I'm a good soldier. I'm going to stay and obey. And I am not going to be a traitor and rebel against what I've sworn loyalty to. But I'm not for all this talk about freeing the slaves, because that's none of my business. That was his thinking. And so when McClellan took over, his first military operations were to occupy the area of Western Virginia that wanted to stay with the Union. And that was the part that eventually became a separate state, the state of West Virginia. So West Virginia, that state used to be part of Virginia, but it broke away from Virginia during the Civil War, and you know, became its own state. And so he went in to occupy that area of Western Virginia that wanted to stay with the Union, and he had received intelligence reports on the 26th of May that the bridge, that some critical Baltimore and Ohio railroad bridges in that portion of the state were being burned. So he wanted to go in and fix that. Baltimore and Ohio Railroad, that was one of the biggest railroads in the country, if not the biggest. One of the prides of Baltimore, the Baltimore and Ohio Railroad. And so they had these train bridges in West Virginia, and they were getting burned. And so McClellan said, oh, okay, we have to go help these people. They want to be free from the Union, and we want to maintain that infrastructure because West Virginia could be a good place, launching pad to attack Richmond again or whatever. So, so as he quickly implemented plans to invade that region of West Virginia, he did something. He triggered like his first kind of controversy by proclaiming to the citizens that his forces had no intentions of interfering with personal property. In other words, as we know, that meant slaves. So his intention was, we're going to West Virginia and we want the citizens of West Virginia to know we're not here to take away your slaves, because that would be like stealing your property, and we're not in the business of stealing the citizens' personal property. So And he said, quote, "Notwithstanding all that has been said by the traitors to induce you to believe that our advent among you will be signalized by interference with your slaves, understand one thing clearly. Not only will we abstain from all such interference, but we will, on the contrary, with an iron hand, crush any attempted insurrection on their part." Unquote. So he was saying, not only won't we take away your slaves, we will help you crush any slave rebellion. If these Negroes want to be free and use the Civil War as an excuse to become free, we will help you suppress them and put them back in their place. That's what he was saying to the people of West Virginia, the people of the state of Virginia that wanted to remain with the Union. If these people were so anti or so pro-slavery, why would they want to stay with Virginia? Why did they want to remain with the Union? You would think this idiot would kind of put two and two together and say, okay, these people are so disgusted by the whole thing that they want to break away from Virginia and be, you know, join the Union. So you would say, oh, these people are not really that hot on slavery. And instead of thinking, okay, then we can use this as, there's no need to win them over by speaking in favor of slavery to a people who clearly are not interested in protecting slavery. That's why they want to break away from Virginia. But so that tells you a lot about him, that he really, really, really was committed to maintaining slavery in his mind. And he kind of quickly realized that he had overstepped his bounds when he said this to the people of West Virginia. And he apologized by a letter to Lincoln. But the irony is that Lincoln agreed with him. So the controversy was not so much that what he said was against Lincoln's policies, because that's exactly what his policies were. But the problem was that he had the boldness to kind of say it as a military, general. So it's like it was not his role as a general to go around saying things like that, supposedly. And that's part of the and that goes to the part of the problem that we want to get to. I don't know if we'll get to it in this audio snippet, but definitely in the next, if not in this one, we have to get to the root of what's basically wrong with, there's something very rotten within the American military system, and it has to be changed. So the thing is, going back to McClellan, he viewed slavery as an institution that was recognized in the Constitution and was entitled to federal protection wherever it existed. And McClellan, after the war, wrote many things, and his writings were kind of consistent with what many Northerners actually thought, unfortunately. And in one time, he wrote, quote, "I confess to a prejudice in favor of my own race, and cannot learn to like the odor of either billy goats or Negroes." But he really didn't say Negroes. He said another word, which I will not repeat here. But I guess you know what word I'm talking about. Unquote. That's what McClellan said, the general in charge of the Union Army put there by stupid son of a bitch Abraham Lincoln. So you have to understand. And he said, I know that he said this after the war, but it's not like he had a change of heart after the war. That's what he thought all along. And Lincoln knew it. I know that Lincoln knew it. But Lincoln said, oh, this guy is, he knows about big war games or big war science, so he's some sort of war genius. He's going to help me end the war quickly so we can get back to business, and I won't go down in history as the president that split the country in two. He didn't care about what was inside the man. He was always looking for what the one who had the most talent, military talent, to get the job done the way he wanted it done. He wasn't looking for character. That's like when in American football, when I used to follow it, I don't care for it anymore, but when I used to follow the NFL and American football, I would always see these coaches that were would salivate over players coming out of college, especially quarterbacks who had these strong arms and could throw like at 200 miles per hour and had these laser passes and could throw the ball like 70 yards without blinking or thinking twice about it. And so they would always look at the physical talent, but they would forget about the character of the player. So they would draft him way high in the NFL draft, and the guy would always end up being a bust. And I would know it, like, that guy doesn't have what it takes. There's something wrong with him. Like Tom Marinovich and so many other players that had so much talent but didn't have the character to succeed. Internal fortitude, I don't know how to explain it. Ryan Leaf, so many players that had that. And the problem is we Americans tend to, in our culture, have this tendency to just look on the outside on stats and numbers and things like that, and not on inner quality of character. It's just this pragmatism that just taints our society. So this McClellan was probably, maybe he was a very brilliant guy in a theoretical setting, but the guy was rotten to the core on the inside, and Lincoln didn't care, and he kept him because he supposedly was a good player who could throw the ball real hard and with supposedly great accuracy, not at game time, but during practices, during the NFL training camps. That's another thing. The NFL is obsessed with how fast is he in the 40-yard dash, how much can he bench press, and all these stupid statistics. And they don't look at the character and how he actually plays on the field. That's another story. But the thing is that it is worth saying that in November of 1861, McClellan did write to his wife, quote, "I will, if successful, throw my sword onto the scale to force an improvement in the condition of those poor blacks," unquote. So there was kind of like a side of him that kind of felt sorry for black people, and sometimes that would come out and say, "Oh, I want to help these guys if it's possible," but and there's that ambivalence that I want to show that was happening within the American soul, and he had that, but at the end of the day, he didn't care for black people at the end of the day. This was the man heading the army that was supposed to fight against the people who wanted to continue with slavery. And the problem with McClellan was that not only was he not anti-slavery and was actually pro-slavery in many ways, you could say, but he was constantly humiliating Lincoln. He privately referred to Lincoln, whom he had known before the war as a lawyer for the Illinois Central. He would refer to him as, quote, "nothing more than a well-meaning baboon," or also a, quote, "gorilla," and, quote, "ever unworthy of his high position." So this guy had a deep disdain for Lincoln. It's like drafting a player from college who hates your organization, who hates your team, who hates your manager, and you're still going to hire draft him because he is the most talented player available at the time of your draft pick. And I've seen that done over and over again. Like the Baltimore Colts, when they used to be in Baltimore, drafted a player called John Elway, who was supposedly, technically, the best athlete on the field, one of the greatest promising quarterbacks to come out of college, because he had this laser arm, a very strong, hard arm, and he hated being drafted by the Colts and said, "I will never play in that horrible city." And he said, "You know, if you force me to play in Baltimore, I'm gonna go play baseball," because he also was drafted by the Yankees, or I forget, he was like a two-sport athlete coming out of college. And when Baltimore saw that, the Colts saw that he was not going to play for them, and they traded him to Denver to go play for the Broncos. And that's why when I was a kid and I saw how he treated Baltimore, I was in Baltimore at the time, I said, "I hate this guy." So I started despising him and hating him and wishing him all sorts of bad luck. And Denver was kind of a good team, and I say that in quotes. There's a lot of context, but not worth discussing here, about how good they really were. But they were good enough to make it to the Super Bowl like three times. And all three times, you know, I would always be kind of praying against this son of a bitch, wishing him the worst. And he got trounced every time, humiliated every time. He was like a big loser. So because the guy had no character, the guy was a little spoiled, little brat, arrogant little brat, and he still is. And then later on, I began to feel sorry for him because he was just this big loser. And I began to cheer for him. I went from praying against him to kind of supporting him. And I really, really strongly supported him when he made it to the Super Bowl again. And he won two Super Bowls and then retired. So he lost three, won two. But because he had kind of like a good beating to his soul. And he finally developed the fortitude inside of him. Before, he was arrogant. He was brash. He thought he could handle the world, win the championship on his own, on the strength of his own greatness and his arm. But he was a nothing. He was a nobody. And it was until people around him were placed and he began to play for the team. And became, had a more of a service attitude in his heart. That's when he was able to win two Super Bowls. And it was like he was given this great offensive line that finally protected him, and he became a team player. And that's when he won. And the point I'm trying to make is, the guy was a jerk. And then he went back to being a jerk. Now he's a jerk again. He is the general manager or something with the Denver Broncos, and he's a total hole in the backside, if you know what I mean. An evil bastard. It's like after winning those two Super Bowls, instead of remaining humble, he went back to what he was before. So, disgusting, worthless bastard. I think he's going to be burning in hell very soon. Who knows? I have no interest in him. But this is the type, and the reason why I'm digressing and talking about sports things is because the analogy applies to the Civil War and to many things that we do as Americans. This constant thing of looking on the outside, on superficial talent, pragmatic parameters to determine what's good, what's not good. And that's why we have such a fickle electoral system. If the economy is good, then the party that's in power gets more people in Congress. When the economy is bad, then we turn around and vote against the people who are in power. We don't care if it's Democrat, Republican. Who is in power? Democrats. Is the economy good? Yes, more Democrats. Let's vote Democrat. You know, is the economy, who's in power? Democrats. Is the economy bad? Yes, let's vote for Republicans. And then, the economy, So it's not that we're voting on principle, it's just pragmatic, very pragmatic, short-term results. And we don't look at the character of people. We don't look at the integrity of people. It's just a cancer in the American culture. And that's why we are where we are. And we are within, I think, 14 months of the country dying completely. And I still don't see any change. So one time in November of 1862, after the midterm elections, Lincoln removed McClellan because of his continued inaction. And that same month, on November 13th, Lincoln went to McClellan's house. This was before he removed him. He went to McClellan's house. He was the president of the United States coming to McClellan's house. And McClellan made him wait for 30 minutes. So he was like upstairs, I guess, in his bedroom or whatever. And Lincoln was downstairs. I don't know if it was a downstairs, upstairs situation. I'm just imagining it. So Lincoln was downstairs just sitting there waiting with his hat and his beard and all that stuff. And he waited for 30 minutes for McClellan to come down and talk to him, the President of the United States. And then after 30 minutes, he was told that the General McClellan had gone to bed and was not going to receive him. Imagine the arrogance of this son of a bitch, this McClellan. Lincoln is beneath me. He really disdained Lincoln. And then Lincoln removed him. I'm sorry, this was 1 year. It was in the same November of 1862, if I'm not mistaken, that then Lincoln said, okay, I've had enough. I'm going to remove this guy. Because McClellan, while he was the leader, the commander of the Union Army, was not really doing anything. Because he really was not in favor of defeating the South and having slavery possibly revoked. He was not in the business of that, so he was just fumbling around and stonewalling. And the war just drug on and on, and Lincoln said, okay, I need someone else. So he then elevated Henry Halleck in July and appointed John Pope as head of the new Army of Virginia. And Pope, he liked this guy, John Pope, because Lincoln wanted to advance on Richmond from the north to protect Washington from a counterattack, because Washington and Richmond are close to each other. But then Pope was soundly defeated in the Second Battle of Bull Run, or Manassas as it's called in the South, in the summer of 1862. So again, Lincoln wanted a quick victory. John Pope came up because McClellan was like, I don't want to do anything. So, okay, you're out of here. So he took John Pope and said, okay, do you want to help me, right? Yes. Okay. Let's go take Richmond. So they try to take Richmond and they failed again. And that forced the Army of the Potomac back to defend Washington, the army that was sent to fight and take Richmond. And McClellan didn't reinforce Pope when he did this attack on Richmond. But despite that, Lincoln restored him to command of all forces around Washington. So you're seeing this man who snubbed him when he visited him at his house, made him wait 30 minutes. The man who behind his back kept calling him a gorilla, a baboon, unworthy of his high position. And then when he got this Pope guy to go attack Virginia, McClellan didn't send reinforcements to help him. And even so, despite all of that, Lincoln said, I need this guy. And he put him in charge of the army of the he put him back to command all the forces around Washington to protect Washington, D.C. So we're seeing here, you know, what was so wrong? Why the war took so long? Why 600,000 Americans died in the Civil War? Because we had a man who was half compromised, surrounded by people who were half compromised, who were acting like they were going to change things, but were there just because they were following orders. They wanted to be good soldiers and obey their superiors. And they didn't want to go down in history as traitors to the military that they had sworn loyalty to. So you had these toy soldiers on the one hand, and this half-compromised man who just wanted to end the conflict and didn't care about the roots of the problems. And then you had some people who would stand up and try to say, no, let's give a moral tone to this. Because there's no point in fighting this war unless we have a moral underpinning to fight it with. And every time someone tried to inject that moral undertone to the fighting in the military, he was put down. And this all has to do with what's at the heart of the army, that cancer that's at the heart of the American military, that we really didn't get to discuss in great detail in this audio snippet. So we will continue talking about the military in the next audio snippet. And I know this is related to Black American to slavery, and hopefully you will see it. It won't look like it on the surface, but if you look at it more closely, hopefully in the next audio snippet, you will see why we're talking about all of this in the context of Black America and slavery. And it has to do with what's wrong with this country, and why the country is dying and will probably be dead in 14 months if things don't change. Thank you very much for listening.